We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. Our topic today is ghosts in the wizarding world. Welcome to Potterversity. Our topic today is ghosts in the wizarding world. I'm Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, director of campus ministry at Ohio Dominican University, and co-editor of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
Wonderful. So Emily, I'm just going to shout out about myself a little bit here. I just realized that I have a publication that just came out.
Yay.
That is at, it's called Asterisks and Anomalies, and it's called Harry Potter and Historical Witness, The Pensive and the Time Turner. We had lots of interest in our talk about memory and the pensive, especially on our previous episode. So any of you are interested in that, you can look it up, Asterisks and Anomalies. And it's got basically the full paper that I did on that. And I'd be interested to have people have a look at it. So
yeah, that's great. And maybe we can link to it in the show notes for the episode.
That would be great. Yeah, we should definitely do that. All right. So we have an appropriately October theme for this episode, ghosts.
Yes, you know I love October and ghosts.
We are going to delve into everything from how ghosts work within this imaginative realm and their thematic significance. And Emily, as our startup question, I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you believe in ghosts?
Oh, yes. So listeners know I am a Catholic, and Catholics have a long tradition of ghosts and spirits. Of course, we so often even refer to the Holy Spirit as the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit, you know, which tells you a lot. But yeah, no, Catholics don't tend to struggle too much traditionally to sort of marry their belief in the afterlife, you know, with a belief that there are some spirits that are disembodied and that they, you know, sometimes appear in the earthly realm, even if they are, you know, located in heaven. So yeah, Catholic, no problem. What about you, Katie? How do ghosts strike you?
Well, I mean, my first instinct is to say no, but like, there's a lot that I feel like I don't know. So I'm a Unitarian Universalist, and that's sort of our guiding principle is, not sure.
Right.
So being open to, like that there are mysteries out there. So I don't really believe in ghosts, I would say, in a way that, you know, is actionable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm open to the idea that there are ways that spirit interacts in the world, that there may be remnants that linger on
traces
in ways that we don't necessarily understand. The house that I used to live in here in Marietta, we moved when we were going to have another kid. But that house, I think maybe had a benevolent spirit in it. Maybe. I mean, I'm not sure I really believed it. It's kind of like I am with my horoscope. I'm not sure, but it was okay. And it was a good explanation for the creaking and stuff. And I didn't feel it was, my instinct was that it was not. Was not malevolent. So have you ever encountered a ghost?
No, I never have. I've always considered myself somebody who's not as sensitive to that reality as maybe some other people are. But I have a very good friend who it was is more sensitive. And she and I did a little investigation at my high school one time. We went on
Ghost
Halloween.
hunters
Yeah, I was a
on
journalist for
Halloween.
my high school newspaper, and so we went to the school. The school permitted us to go to the school on Halloween at like 7 o'clock at night. So it was like just getting dark, you know. And we walked the halls, and we set up tape recorders, and we yeah, it was really fun. It was
Oh
a
my
really fun
gosh,
high
that's
school
fun.
project, and it got a lot of reads, I think, in our high school paper. And she did feel that she sensed some things, so I brought her as my medium. But did you know that there's ghost stories in the Bible? I just was reminded of this in 1 Samuel chapter 28. Saul conjures the spirit. He uses this the diviner of Endor, right? Not just for Ewoks, not just for Ewoks. The diviner of Endor helps him conjure the spirit of Samuel, who then kind of prophesies that, you know, it's not going to go well for Saul. So it's a very interesting and intriguing story. So folks who read scripture, you know, if somebody tells you you're not allowed to believe in ghosts, well, you know, the problem is it's right there in the Bible.
Well, that's really cool. I am so excited to talk about this today. I'm feeling in the fall spirit, you know, and ghosts, I think, are just part of that. We're in the, you know, we're headed toward winter. We're headed toward that season of, you know, of death or hibernation or however you want to think about it. And so I think that makes for a great topic. Joining us for our discussion today are two returning guests. First, Louise Freeman, who was just on talking to us about memory in the Harry Potter series. Louise is Professor Emerita of Psychology at Mary Baldwin University, licensed behavior analyst, and service provider for special needs individuals. She has written and presented on many aspects of Harry Potter and psychology, as well as on the Cormoran Strike series. And along with Louise, we're delighted to be joined by David Martin, Hufflepuff extraordinaire, and part of the winning team on the Hogwarts Tournament of Houses quiz show back in 2021. He's also the author of the book, 12 Failsafe Ways to Charm Witches and Other Thoughts About Harry Potter, and a grandfather of four. Welcome back to the show, Louise and David.
Thank
Well,
you.
thank you.
It's fun to be here, as always.
This is great. I'm so glad that you're here to join us for this conversation. So let's just dive right in because we know that Hogwarts is like ghost central in the books.
Replete with ghosts.
Yes. Why does Hogwarts have ghosts? Why is it so filled with ghosts? And do we think that there are ghosts elsewhere outside of Hogwarts?
I was rereading the part in Book Five where Harry, after the death of Sirius Black, talks to Nearly Headless Nick and tries to ask Nick about how ghosting works. And one of the things Nick says is that only a wizard can become a ghost. So that would immediately, you know, where are there lots of wizards in Britain? Duh, at Hogwarts. There are obviously, however, ghosts elsewhere because I think of the ones who came to Nearly Headless Nick's death day party. I also think, and here I'll review my prejudice right up front. I think that ghosts are representations of the past and the influence of the past on the present. And boy, you're sitting there in a castle that's 1,000 years old. You've got a lot of past to deal with.
Exactly, yeah.
So true.
One thing about ghosts I really don't understand. According to Nearly Headless Nick, basically a wizard decides to be a ghost, decides not to go on. This indicates some agency on the part of the individual. Okay, remember the Headless Hunt? There are ghost horses. How does a horse become a ghost?
I think if you're a ghost that owns a horse, you can take your horse with you. Maybe.
Oh,
All
okay.
right.
I like that. I
If you
like
have a
that.
close relationship
Is the horse okay with this?
Do we normally ask horses if they're okay with what we make them do?
My
H
God.
hey, you know, as Mark Anthony Lewis likes to say, Harry Potter has a
It's a
consent
consent
problem, and this
problem.
extends to horse ghosts. So.
Louise, what do you think? Like, why Hogwarts?
Well, I think the number one reason is just the gothic element that is so strong in the stories. I know people like Beatrice Grove have written very extensively about the debt Hogwarts and the whole Harry Potter series owes to the traditional Gothic novel. And, you know, your Gothic novel, your old castle has to have ghosts in it. That's just one of those things it has to have, like creaking floorboards and a mad woman locked in the attic or things like that. You have to have those. So I think it is just part of that atmosphere that Rowling was trying to create in this magical castle, is that you had to have ghosts. What I think is interesting is how they're used, like the house ghosts. Okay, when does your house get its ghost mascot, and who gets to decide? All right, you're the official Gryffindor ghost, and you're the official Hufflepuff ghost, and you're the official, you know, as opposed to the other ghosts that might be hanging around who might have been in those houses. I mean, Moaning Myrtle was a Ravenclaw, but she doesn't get to be the Ravenclaw ghost. She has to, you know, that it's Helena Ravenclaw. So, you know, was this like the first ghost from that house who came back and haunted Hogwarts? Yeah, I think it's interesting. They're almost like mascots in some way.
Yeah, and you think, like, is this a good job? Is this something they're going to want to rotate out of? Right, being the house ghost.
Committee membership.
So need a sabbatical from being the Gryffindor ghost.
You can see from what the scene that David describes at the end of Order of the Phoenix, where Harry is trying to talk to Nick about ghosts and how they work. And Nick is trying to get away from him. He does not want to have this conversation. And he's like, I've been expecting this. Because this is what happens. Somebody loses somebody, and then they're right away, they're like, I got to talk to some ghosts. And you get the sense that he's kind of over it, kind of tired of it. He feels awkward about it. And of course, he doesn't want to reveal what he feels sort of a shameful, you know, cowardice about dying. Yeah. And so he's helpful in a sense of providing some information, but he's not like emotionally helpful in this way. And, you know, you sort of think, maybe, I mean, is it a burden? I mean, not that the Bloody Baron, like, I think the Bloody Baron could get out of it if he wanted to. He's the Slytherin ghost, right?
Right.
So what's keeping him rattling the chains?
I love the way that we are only a few minutes into this episode and already ghosts are just inviting so much mystery, so much kind of pondering of mystery. And I think that that is a huge part of how they function in the books, is just to invite you to think about the realm beyond, you know, and to, you know, Katie, as you said, to acknowledge that you don't know, you know, you really don't know what lies beyond death.
But also, like, think about, like, we think about the obligations of the living to the dead, but do we think the dead have an obligation to the living in the way that Nick, right, had some kind of obligation maybe to try to explain what happened there? Well, maybe that's a hard question to address. I don't know if anybody has thoughts on it.
You know, I will say that the one time I felt like, I don't know if I feel like I was experiencing a ghost, but I did feel like I felt the presence of a recently deceased person, and that person had died under very tragic circumstances. And it almost seemed to me like the person felt that they owed me an explanation. And I had a strong sense of that. Again, it was probably more spiritual in a religious sense than spiritual in a ghostly sense, although I'm not positive that's a fair distinction at all. But that's an interesting question. Katie made me think about that.
Yeah. So, and I don't know. Like, I don't know. Maybe it's just, again, it's one of these mysteries to ponder, perhaps. I did sort of think I would just read out from in the J.K. Rowling archive on Wizarding World, which I always want to call Pottermore, but Wizarding World website. The entry on ghosts does directly address this question. I mean, not that we feel beholden necessarily to what she says about it, but this is what she says. Hogwarts is the most heavily haunted dwelling place in Britain, and this is against stiff competition, as there are more reported ghost sightings / sensings on these damp islands than anywhere else in the world. The castle is a congenial place for ghosts because the living inhabitants treat their dead friends with tolerance and even affection, no matter how many times they've heard the same old reminiscences. So I think that in some ways has some of that, right? That the you know, that there's, and this is maybe the obligations of the living to the dead, but it's a congenial place. Like, it's a place they can gather.
Yeah, and you can tell your stories over again here. It's fine.
There's a critical mass of ghosts there. And like you say, it's a castle. The gothic element that both David and Louise brought up, I think is buried in that description as well. Well,
Love it.
let's actually drill down into some of these mysteries. Let's try to figure this out. There should be some rules of how ghosts work, right? And
We
how do they
know
operate?
Rowling loves rules. So, yes,
Yeah.
indeed.
Well, there are rules, but they're often broken. So,
Yeah, well.
but let's think about this a little bit based on like clues from the books and so on that we might have. And the biggest part where we get an explanation is that part that David brought up right at the end, where we learn something about how one becomes a ghost. But what do we know about even things like how do these ghosts communicate with each other, and like how do they interact with the physical world around them?
I think this is part of the wizarding world too, is that they can physically move liquids and gases, but not solids. So that's why Moaning Myrtle can splash the water when she dives into the
Ah.
toilet, or you can, maybe feel a breeze or feel some sort of temperature change when you pass through them, because it's their interaction with the air cooling it down for some reason. They seem to look pretty much as they did when they died, in terms of, Moaning Myrtle's there in her school uniform. Nick's got there with his head nearly chopped off. The Bloody Baron's covered in blood. That seems to be a rule. I think this is another Wizarding World thing. I think this is from the first Fantastic Beasts book, is that the Ministry had to create a new category for them, as because they were trying to distinguish between a being and a beast. The ghost mostly met the definitions of being, and that they could speak language and they could interact as humans and various things like that. But it seemed insensitive to call them beings, because they are the, you know, they have they are no longer beings. They are,
There has beens,
yes.
I think
So
is what's I think that's what it says.
yeah.
There has
So
beens.
they invented this new category of spirit
Yeah.
to accommodate them. So, but that is an interesting question. I think we'll talk about this later, that, the ministry does seem to regulate ghosts a bit, just like they regulate magic and wizards and witches. You talked about Moaning Myrtle, for instance, haunting Olive Horns, the girl who was teasing
Yeah,
her,
yeah.
and that she was following around and torturing her. And eventually Olive went to the ministry, and the ministry made Myrtle go and live in the Hogwarts bathroom instead. So there was apparently some sort of means of control that the ministry had over a ghost. So they're subject to certain laws, even by the Ministry of Magic.
I'm thankful for your distinction that ghosts can handle cannot handle solid, but can apparently handle liquids and air, because that explains a little detail I was wondering about. When Nearly Headless Nick is, I don't know what, re-killed or something by the basilisk, what they do to try to move him up to the hospital wing is somebody's told to kind of get a big fan or something and blow him along.
They're
That,
wafting him.
wafting him, and so that explains how that works. I also noticed that, well, in addition to horses, which I've already mentioned, there seem to be all kinds of ghostly objects. Nick has this fancy dress that he has. They continually refer to him adjusting his collar and having his, and then he has a letter, which is an envelope. I think there's an envelope about it. Maybe not. Maybe it's just folded. But this suggests to me there's this whole category of ghostly objects that only ghosts can touch. I mean, if Harry tried to pick up the letter, I have a hunch his hand would just go through it. Does this mean there are ghostly owls that carry them? I don't know. Maybe.
I love that idea that there's a whole other realm there. And I wonder, are these objects that they had in their life that they've somehow brought with them? As people bury people with special objects and so on, with the idea they'll carry them into the afterlife, like something like that maybe happening. I also like the idea, right, sort of thinking about the importance of that they can move air, but also that explains the Death Day feast. right? Where they have all this
Oh, yeah.
horrible smelling stuff
Rotted food.
because that's, you know, in order for them to even appreciate anything to do with the food, it has to really smell. And so
Right.
that suggests that interaction with air that you mentioned.
Right. Yes. Yeah, that's really true. That's a whole other, there's a whole other layer of that with regard to food and the way that food is used in the series to indicate sort of goodness, wholesomeness, and a right
Yeah.
attitude toward the afterlife, and then bad food associated with danger and also a bad, you know, attitude toward the afterlife, like a not recommended attitude toward the afterlife. And the ghosts are clearly on that side of the food line in Harry Potter.
Well, I think one of the things that might be an interesting question to consider here is I think obviously the ghosts do speak out loud, right, in ways that everybody can hear. And so it's not really like Emily, what you were describing before, where I'm guessing that that was the feeling that you had, the owed explanation. I'm guessing you didn't feel like you actually heard that through the airwaves,
No,
but
no.
it seems like the ghosts, they're audible. Way that, like, and not just their voices, but we do know that there's the chain rattling and all that.
Right. They can communicate through our senses, our
Yeah.
tactile senses, yeah.
And they don't seem to age. Yes, they seem like they're frozen in time.
At the
Would you
point of
agree with
death.
that? At the point of
Yeah.
death?
Yeah, I'm sorry to inflict my predetermined opinions here, but if ghosts represent the past, one of the most fundamental things about the past, proclaimed in 100,000 country music songs, so you know it's true, is that you can't change it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you were a ghost, you were alive, bang, you're dead. Now you're in that state forever. I think also about people who die young, and that's the only image we ever have of them. Marilyn Monroe will always be whatever it was, 32. All right. And any image you conjure up of her will always have her at that age. That's part of why they don't change.
Right. There's maybe a sense that there's not an evolution that happens after death. But I think one of the questions we might ask is, are there evolution? Do we see any of the ghosts evolving, not in a sort of physical or visible way, but in an emotional way?
Well, we had Moaning Myrtle, who was, you know, known for basically self-pity. That was kind of her whole spiel. You know, by Half-Blood Prince, she is actually feeling sorry for and trying to console Draco Malfoy. Now, that may reflect more about how far Draco has fallen, if Moaning Myrtle is feeling sorry for you. But you can see maybe a little bit, you know, she has this frightened, miserable boy hanging around her bathroom, and she seems to have developed some compassion for him. So that's one example. I think we had Helena Ravenclaw say, you know, kind things about Luna. You know, she's one of the kind students, that she doesn't treat me badly or anything like that, in terms of so there seems to be some sort of emotional connection there.
And I think also the fact that Rowena Ravenclaw talks about having been basically persuaded by Tom Riddle, this suggests a certain kind of, well, change, evolution of sorts, in the wrong direction, it turned out.
And of course, then Harry comes along and also persuades her, okay, you know, she's so upset that he has defiled this diadem with his dark magic. It's like, I want to destroy it for you. Will you let me do that? And well, okay. And she has that persuadable nature with him as well.
Yeah, so they're not powerless, obviously, right? They do have some agency even as ghosts, and they're definitely affecting the story in some key ways. You know, I'm interested in I'm going to call it the science of what happens to Nick when he sees the basilisk and he's frozen, like he's dead. What is
Yeah,
that?
how can you
What is
petrify a
that?
spirit?
I think maybe he's paralyzed. because one can be paralyzed and still be alive in whatever sense Nick is alive. So maybe that's what's happening.
Again, it does suggest interaction with the, you know, with the world.
I've always had a hard time understanding exactly what being petrified does to humans too, because it seems to like render them completely motionless.
Yeah. Is it like stasis?
Is it, you know, if you are entirely stiff as a board, can't move, then you cannot breathe.
Right.
And so that should be a fatal condition. You shouldn't be able to exist in this state indefinitely and then be revived. I don't know. I think the petrification curse is this weird anyway, because it's something, it should be a death stare. It should be like Avada Kedavra and kill you instantly. But if you weaken it a little bit by making it a reflection in a mirror or in water and stuff like that, then Justin Benchley got petrified, but he didn't die because he only saw the basilisk through Nick. And so that there was that shading of him. So petrification is a hard thing to understand with humans. So I don't think we have much chance.
Right. It doesn't really shake out
like
very well.
A weakened Avada Kedavra because of a reflection or a disruption in this eye contact thing.
Well, the business of looking at the monster in the mirror, it's right out of Greek mythology, right? Mm-hmm. This was in the
Medusa.
Medusa. Yeah, that if you even looked at Medusa, you would turn to stone. And so, as I recall, the Greek hero is hunting Medusa with a mirror. So that he's not exposed to it directly.
These are kind of low stakes people to take out of the narrative also. You know, I mean, I just kind of think about this as like, you know, plot structure and all these things and like what has to happen. I mean, first of all, it's book two, you know, you can't go around killing a bunch of people in this book. Like, it's not okay. You know, like, didn't Disney just cancel a Star Wars show for killing too many Jedi? You know, spoiler alert. But, you know, the thing is, like, you know, taking Nick out of the plot doesn't really affect much. Taking Mrs. Norris out of the plot just makes it safer to roam the halls at night, you know. And then finally they take Hermione, you know, and it's like, oh boy, you know, this really got consequential. But again, of course, she's only petrified, you know, she's not dead. So yeah, so there's some plot necessities, I think, controlling that issue as well.
Okay, so let's think about this though. Is Peeves a ghost? I know he's a poltergeist.
What's the difference?
But well, like, do we think that there was a Peeves back in the day, like a walk and talk?
Well, Peeves can clearly interact with solid things because he can like drop safes and stuff like on you and throw chalk at you and all that type of stuff. So he has to be somehow different from ghosts, but he seems to be categorized. He's probably, I guess the ministry would call him a spirit, but something that's different from a ghost.
Maybe a somewhat symbolic interpretation. Peeves is the representation of chaos, or he's the representation of Murphy's Law, that something will always go wrong, if it can go wrong. And that you have this big old castle. Guess what? The plumbing is occasionally going to leak. The stones are occasionally going to fall out. And so you blame it all on the randomness of the world. Poltergeist just means noisy spirit from the German. But yes, Peeves obviously can move things around. He's persuaded to drop that cabinet in order to get Harry off. And I also remember when we first see ghosts drifting towards the entry hall, they've just been discussing what to do about Peeves. And this is when Harry and the other students first see ghosts. Somebody is saying, I forget who, that there's just been a meeting of the ghosts council to decide what to do about Peeves. And somebody says, he gives us all a bad name and he's not even really a ghost.
Peeves, if he can interact with objects, that actually makes him somewhat like the ghosts in Noel Coward's Blythe Spirit. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It was one of the first plays I ever acted in as a teenager. So I was. It's a kind of a farcical comedy. This man invites a medium into his home. He doesn't. He widower. He has a second wife, and the medium winds up conjuring the first wife back, and the first wife wants to kill him so she can be reunited because she's jealous of the second wife. And anyway, she winds up accidentally killing the second wife instead, so they both wind up coming back. Anyway, it's a very funny play, but this particular ghost, okay, people cannot touch her. They establish that. She's visible and audible only to her husband. No one else can see or hear her, but she can pick up objects. She carries, that's how she convinces the second wife she's there, is she picks up a vase and carries it across the room. And, you know, the woman just sees this floating vase. And of course she winds up killing the second wife by tampering with the car. So she cuts the brakes or whatever. So she, that's an example of a ghost that can interact with objects, but cannot be touched by people. So that sounds like Peeves to me.
I feel like that's consistent with a lot of like accounts of ghosts that you know, people encounter, you know, where things are knocked over or things are not where they were left. Yeah. And so that does seem to be part of our ghost lore as well.
Yeah. And is Peeves ever described? I know the ghosts are always described as silvery, white, transparent things. David, I believe you answered a question on that at some point during the Tournament of Houses, if I remember correctly. But is Peeves ever described as silvery white, or is he more natural colors, I guess, whatever a natural color for a poltergeist is?
He's definitely not described as transparent, for instance. I don't know whether I've actually read this, but I envision him as being dressed like a jester.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with a dangly hat, even. The Weasley twins are flying out, and they say, "Peeves, give her hell." And Peeves takes off his hat and bows to them on the way out. All right, so Peeves wears a hat. Good. I don't know what else we know about his appearance.
Yeah, so our producer, Lori Beckoff, did her Chestnut Hill paper, I don't know, was it a couple years ago now, on Peeves as a kind of puckish, and like you said, an emblem of chaos, David, and randomness. Mm-hmm. That is actually, it's a stylistic character choice that you see in a fair amount of like Renaissance literature and so on. So she had lots of cool things to say there. And I guess, I think we've established he's not a ghost, but you know, that he, in some ways, he doesn't have a past. And David, to get to your point, that the ghosts are really a manifestation of the past in the present, and they're not the only ones in the wizarding world or at Hogwarts in particular. Of course, we have the people in the paintings who can represent people from the past. But then we've also got Tom Riddle coming out of the Diary Horcrux.
Oh, yeah.
You might even think about the Harry's parents in the Mirror of Erised, or, you know, how they come from the Resurrection Stone at the very end. Or how about when they do the Priori Incantatum, mm-hmm. and they come out of the intersection of Voldemort's and Harry's wands in Goblet of Fire. And so there are some like other things that are not, I don't think we would call them ghosts. I'm not sure if they're ghosts, but there are other really active, dynamic ways to communicate with the past in the mm-hmm. wizarding world. And how do ghosts relate to some of those? Like, what's different? You know, are they really serving the same purpose?
First of all, of ghosts versus the Mirror of Erised, the people in the Mirror of Erised do not speak to you. They very much just seem to be an image of your imagination. And particularly you see this in Ron. What does he see, you know? He sees, obviously, not in the past, but into the future.
I think that we are to believe that Harry actually does see not just his imagination of what his parents look like, but what his parents actually look like. And actually, in the books, his whole family in the back. Yeah. And so there does seem like there's some outside reality there, that it's not just from his imagination, but I'm not sure. Maybe that's a whole other line of question.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, he didn't even know what they looked like.
Yeah, I think you're right. What Ron sees is clearly imagination. One difference between the ghosts and the painting is that characters in paintings can move to other paintings within Hogwarts and can move to images of themselves elsewhere, but otherwise they're kind of geographically limited. Whereas ghosts just seem to. I remember one time when the castle is being locked down in book three because they think Sirius Black is somewhere. Dumbledore gives a direction to Pettigrew. If you need to communicate, send a message by one of the ghosts. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Ghosts can run chores for us of a minor sort. And it is obviously they are the completely invulnerable ones in a sense who can move about. I think they're also used during the Battle of Hogwarts to carry messages. And I also noticed in the Battle of Hogwarts that there's no ghosts on Voldemort's side.
Oh, that is interesting.
That's right. Well, I mean, the way he hates death, I guess he wouldn't want a ghost around him.
Oh, yes.
Be a reminder of death, and he would not. That is a very cool observation. I
But
love
yeah, that is classic David Martin. It's one of those
that.
very sort of simple observations, but it's got a whole host of sort of implications to it that I just love your perspective, David. And as opposed to Harry, who he and his friends actually go to a death day party. I mean, they could have said no. Like they miss the Halloween feast among the living to attend this death day party, you know, just out of friendship for Nick and out of the desire not to hurt his feelings, you know. And so this is a big contrast to Voldemort, who
But it
won't have.
shows that shows respect for death and for the dead that goes beyond. I mean, they're kind of just doing it to be polite, but that is, I mean, you know, Confucianism has that sense of polite, but it's really deep. It's a really kind of deep human connectedness, and that, you know, that respect for the dead, I think, has this larger meaning, of course.
Right,
Yeah.
as opposed to Voldemort, who breaks into Dumbledore's grave to obtain the
Right.
Elder Wand, right? That is not respect for the dead, you know.
If we want to talk about respect for the dead, we have two graveyard scenes. We have a graveyard scene in Goblet of Fire, in which a grave is broken open and bone of the father is taken. And we also have a murder committed. And by the way, we see yew trees all around, which are symbols both of death and of resurrection. And then we have the graveyard scene in book seven when they go and find the graves. And that in that case, the graveyard is treated with complete respect and I would argue reverence. They read the graves and they leave a wreath. So yeah, very, very, very different attitudes towards death.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm thinking about, just kind of going back to something that you said a little earlier, David, that the ghosts are hard to harm. You know, except Nearly Headless Nick and the Basilisk aside, they're hard to harm, but the paintings are more vulnerable. You have them all cowering, right? Because they're in the, you know, you've got the fat lady who's so worried about what has happened, you know, with Sirius Black trying to get in. And so the paintings are more vulnerable, maybe because they're material.
Hermione blindfolding
Yeah.
Phineas T. Jones so he can't see her.
Right.
I think that
But you
was.
can't do that with a ghost, because the ghosts, they're more invulnerable, I guess. How about, what do we think about ghosts in comparison with the Tom Riddle Horcrux? Is he a ghost? He's something else.
Both he and the Resurrection Stone versions of James Lily, Lupin, and Sirius are described as more solid than ghosts. They're not solid, but they're more solid than ghosts. So I picture them as maybe having color again, and not being the silver or white thing, but being maybe transparent, but, you know, with the same color hair, the same color eyes, skin, everything like that, looking like they did in life. It's not clear to what extent they can interact with, again, people or solid things. Is it just in the movie, or is it also in the book that they tell Harry in the book, we can hold Voldemort off for just a second? So it's sounds like they can do something physically to him, although not much and for a very limited time. They can interact, they can physically restrain him, or maybe they're just going to terrify him. I don't know. It's not quite clear what they're doing to hold Voldemort back so Harry can get Cedric's body and get away. But
well, and maybe they know about Voldemort's deep discomfort with death, you know, and maybe it is a terrorizing him, you know, too, because it's just interesting because the agency is there. It's just really limited. And, you know, is it in the film that they sort of rush at him? You know, yeah. I don't remember if it's described that way in the book, but and I'm not sure Harry would be able to know because he's busy doing other things. But it is interesting that they even play upon his fear of death to have that agency in the world.
Yeah, so interesting. Like I'm just thinking about the idea that they, you know, somehow their spirit has been recalled by Priory Incantatum. And it's kind of ghostly, but that's not right because they didn't become ghosts. They're not ghosts, but it is some remnant of them that's being called
almost
for.
Like
shades.
Like the one that killed them contained a remnant of their soul, maybe.
Yeah.
They're able to pull it back out again.
Yeah, Dumbledore says it's a reverse echo, whatever that means.
Echo.
And therefore, now another difference I would see between Tom Riddle, who emerges from the Horcrux, and a ghost, is the Tom Riddle who emerges from the Horcrux is the Horcrux. He is 1/7 of a living soul, whereas a ghost is all of a gone person. I guess I'd raise the question: suppose you make a Horcrux, and both you and your Horcrux are killed. Is there one ghost or two?
Yeah, I would think the soul would have to come back together and be complete in order to be a ghost. Yeah.
Yeah, because Voldemort doesn't become a ghost when, you know, when his spell rebounds on him when he's trying to kill Harry. He doesn't become a ghost. He becomes this other thing, right? Yeah. That is something, and that's what's the remnant of the soul and the Horcrux, and it's not ghostly at all. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're thinking about the scene in the forest when we see Harry and Dumbledore in King's Cross.
Yes,
the thing under the bench.
Yeah, but also whoever Quirrell discovered in Albania. whatever he discovered was not a ghost. You know,
that thing Peter Pettigrew was, yeah, it's almost like it's a fetus or
the weird baby
sort of
thing.
Little, yeah, weird.
Well, I mean, the narrative casts clear judgment on anything but the unification of the soul, you know, anything but the oneness and wholeness of the soul. So, yeah, that's interesting to think. You would assume that would mean, David, in that scenario, that the soul would come together sort of naturally. Like, it's a natural thing for a soul to be whole and intact rather than, you know, separate.
Yeah, one of the questions I pose to people occasionally is, first of all, there's a wonderful little touch in the death scene there in the book where it says, Harry's charm meant the charm from Voldemort, and reversed, and Tom Riddle fell dead.
Mm-hmm.
But just that wonderful little switch of names there. But then what bothers me, and I've asked people about this, is they just say the body was taken and laid in a room to the side. And we can hear more about that. And I'm thinking about how, for instance, how carefully they disposed, the Israelis disposed of the body of the Nazi war criminal they caught, Adolf Eichmann. They cremated it, and then they spread the ashes in the middle of the Mediterranean because they didn't want to leave anything that might be a site for people to regroup. And so I was wondering, considering that Voldemort has already beat death once, how do you make sure that there's not some kind of residual magic?
Yeah, and I think that is really tied to this theme that Rowling is definitely working, that, you know, these kinds of, types of evil, they do reoccur in successive generations, that they just do come back. And, you know, constant vigilance, you know, there is always going to be some need because they do come back around, the cyclical nature of authoritarianism and, you know, human cruelty and so on. And so it is interesting that they don't really do any, we don't know more about the body than that.
And this is part of why, and I'm sure I've said this on the podcast before, so forgive me, listeners, but I absolutely hate what they did in the films with Voldemort upon his death, because he becomes, you know, like on the air, like everyone's like breathing him in, and like, it's just, I know, it's just horrific. Like what, and I mean, maybe that's me as a Catholic. We have a prohibition against scattering ashes. Like cremation is okay in the Catholic tradition, but you may not scatter ashes. They must be buried, you know, and maybe that's me reacting to that, but that was a really, you know, it may have looked cool and it may have been an attempt to make his death definitive, but for me, it did the absolute opposite.
I totally agree with you. That's from the Episcopalian point of view.
Good to know. We have ecumenical.
And you've talked before, Emily, about the, you know, the body just boom falling is a way of showing Voldemort was a human being.
He weren't special.
It.
Yeah, that's exactly. It. He was less.
There's one small thing that bothers me about Voldemort's name. The French verb that's at the front there, voler, actually has two meanings. One is to fly, is what airplanes do and what Superman does. The other means is to steal. What a thief does. And so I'm wondering if this is, what would theft of death be? Or is it flight from death? What flight from death immediately makes sense, but.
Well, to steal from death, isn't that like how the three brothers are attempting to defeat death in that way? Not just running away from it.
To scam it, to scam death.
Yeah, but to actually steal from it. And then to be able to, like, he likes to kill other people, Voldemort does.
And, so. Of course, he stole most of his Horcruxes as well. They were valuables that he stole from other people. He didn't have to do that. He could have used, you know, a rock or, you know, something ordinary. That
right, he could have bought some stuff off eBay.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, whatever. You know, yeah, get a nice crystal vase or something like that. I'll keep my soul there.
He did have a nice diary.
Yeah, diary. The snake, I guess, was okay, but most of the other ones he actually stole from people and killed them at the same time. So
yeah, so let's move on to talk a little bit about how the ghosts in the Wizarding World relate to other ghost figures, and we could do an entire episode probably just on this, but Louise has already brought in Blythe Spirit. I think some other ones that we might think about are the Ghost TV series, which that's kind of fun, right? Where there's a British version and there's an American version of that. But then you've got like Patrick Swayze.
Oh, yeah.
Demi Moore, right? So Patrick Swayze's ghost there, which is operating by certain rules and certainly also seems to, you know, he's got messages, not from the other world, but messages from his own past. Of course, The Sixth Sense, that's one of my favorite movies of all time. But also The Ghost and the Christmas Carol. We can't talk about all of these, but like, what do you all think? Are the ghosts in Harry Potter world, are they referencing some of those, you know, obviously not the Ghost TV show, but some of the other, especially like Hamlet or Christmas Carol ghosts, or are they doing something kind of different and new?
There's two differences that jump out to right immediately. When you compare the Hogwarts ghosts with other ghosts, the Hogwarts ghosts are old, or whatever you call it, to talk about how long a person has been dead. The youngest ghost we meet is Moaning Myrtle. She's been dead for 50 years. The oldest we meet is probably the Grey Lady. That's 900 or 1,000. Meanwhile, Marley is 7 years dead. Hamlet's father is a year, maybe 2 years recent. Patrick Swayze's ghost is right there, except for the TV show ghosts. We've got some ghosts going back several centuries. The other ghosts we mentioned, including my favorite Topper from the 1937 movie Topper, they're real recent. You know, they died halfway through the movie, you know, versus the Hogwarts ghost. The other is particularly Marley. Marley brings back messages of death, of judgment beyond death, you know, and change your life, reform your life. Whereas the Hogwarts ghost said, oh yeah, the sorting hat has said things like that before. Oh yeah, how I died? Well, I was sitting over there and I saw some eyes. You know, they tell you history of this world. And as nearly as Nick's made, makes clear, they don't seem to know anything about the coming world.
Yeah, and I mean, the classic example of that is our ghost teacher, Professor Benz, who, and he's more recent ghost, but he's not telling you anything recent. He's telling you really old, really, really old stuff.
Yeah, I get the impression he's like a century or two.
You know what? I don't really know. I just assumed he was a more recent, his was a more recent death, but maybe not. But I think that's really, that's a sort of tantalizing difference to potentially explore, in the sense that ghosts, you know, that we're seeing at Hogwarts, that is not a kind of plot device where, except for Moaning Myrtle, where they are communicating, you know, things in the recent or a recent past that are of immediate interest to the present, that they're actually giving you a kind of wider context. But Emily's going to disagree with me.
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking about Rowena Ravenclaw and the Grey Lady.
Mm-hmm.
But, right. I mean, that's that is also like Myrtle. You know, she is communicating information that Harry needs.
Yeah, but
to
it's
solve
really
the story
old.
Problem.
And what I think is interesting is that this, and maybe it's this, we're back to the Gothic, but the idea is that there are these old problems and struggles that still have to be worked through,
that bear upon us today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm also intrigued that we never see anyone become a ghost. You know, Harry is hopeful that Sirius will come back as a ghost, but Nick sets him straight that that is not a thing to be hoped, you know, that this isn't a good thing. And of course, he doesn't really say that, but his, you know, his shame, as you said before, Katie, comes through, his shame in this, mm-hmm. you know, making this choice.
I do remember that Moaning Myrtle kind of hopes Harry will become a ghost, because then she tells him that he can share her U-bed.
She is disturbingly a little bit of a flirt.
Oh, yeah.
Like her interest in Draco also. I mean, you know, Draco, good looking kid, right? You know? She is creepy in more ways than one.
Oh, yeah. If you've seen Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, she shows up in that, and it's she is not just flirty. She is like sex crazed, I guess.
Ew.
I mean, she is really after the grown up Harry. I mean, she's funny. It's one of the funniest parts of the Cursed Child movie, or the Moaning Myrtle scenes. But, and of course, part of it, of this actress that was playing her in the version I saw, was just really, really funny and really throwing herself into that role.
I wonder if we'll ever get a film adaptation of that.
I sure hope we do.
Yeah, me too, because I still haven't managed to see it.
Yeah, you know, I'm game for all the Harry Potter content. I'm there. So
plus I can pause it and get up and get myself a snack if it's
one of the, I think, the tropes of using ghosts in literature is the idea that the person who died had unfinished business, and so they're coming back because they're, you know, that's Patrick Swayze. Like, unfinished business, or there's, you know, there's something that's unresolved in their life that is keeping them in this plane. And like Nearly Headless Nick, I feel like the nearly headless bit is almost suggestive of that. I think that Professor Benz, he's just not finished teaching history, obviously, right? Moaning Myrtle, she's got her revenge that she's working out. But what about some of the other ghosts? Do we think that they have some unfinished business that's keeping them? Maybe, I mean, the Bloody Baron and the Grey Lady. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Helena Ravenclaw was clearly feeling a lot of guilt for stealing her mother's diadem and craving her mother's power and her mother's wisdom and how she behaved in life. And I think the Bloody Baron then was sort of atoning for having killed her. So they, I think, are sort of the ghosts that can't move on because they feel guilty about what they did in life. Nick's frustration is that he can't be in the headless hunt. I don't know that he was eager to be completely decapitated in life. I guess one would rather be completely decapitated than partially, but I don't know exactly that. That's his great long is to be in the headless hunt, but that's something that occurred after his death, not before it.
Yeah, but I think you can see that as an extension of his status seeking, as he's described. You know, his backstory is described in the Wizarding World essay about him, that he, you know, he was somebody who was at Henry VII's court, and he was actually, you know, trying to help a lady to look more beautiful or something, and kind of got caught doing magic. And so there's
I don't think I've ever read that story.
There's some status seeking that, you know, maybe we can see at least reflective in his ghostly life, although that doesn't seem like maybe so much unfinished business, because he tells us it's not really unfinished business that keeps him as a ghost. It's fear. It's fear of death. That's not what's keeping him, but maybe there's continuity there. Emily?
Well, I think that is unfinished business in this narrative, because this narrative, as I have said many times, is, you know, all about the business of becoming okay with death. That's what Harry ultimately, you know, when he meets Dumbledore in King's Cross, Dumbledore says, "You brave boy, you something something man." So Dumbledore finishes the progress. That is Harry becoming an adult, because he has learned not to fear death and to understand that there is a part of him that is eternal. And so, yeah, so that really is unfinished business, fear of death in this narrative.
Like, if we sort of feel like the Bloody Baron and the Grey Lady, if they had resolution, I don't know if we think they had resolution, but would they then go on? Nearly Headless Nick doesn't seem to hold out the idea that you could, as a ghost, ever go on.
I think it's surprising that we don't see an instance of that.
You know, I wonder, again, you know, given that we do, there is some precedent for some ministry control over ghosts. You know, are there exorcism or banishing spells? You know, there's traditional ways that we Muggles, if we think we have a ghost, can get rid of it. You know, sprinkle cold water.
Wafting.
You call Ghostbusters.
You got to call. Yeah. Okay. But I wonder if the ministry has a means of getting rid of ghosts, does that send them on, or does that send them into, you know, oblivion or something? I don't know.
I think it might, if the ministry was seeking to get rid of ghosts, I would suspect it might be because the ghost was was causing trouble with Muggles. And so you might do much as happened with Moaning Myrtle, that the ghost is, for instance, driven out of a particular territory, or perhaps restricted to a given territory someplace else. Based on the conversation in King's Cross, it's very clear that Harry's being given the choice at that time whether to go on or to come back to life, as it were.
Get on the train.
What I've always wondered about, and I guess this is written deliberately ambiguously, is whether or not the Dumbledore that we see in King's Cross exists only in Harry's head, or if it is in some representation, the spirit of Dumbledore, the same spirit we see in Dumbledore's portrait, when he tells that portrait, for instance, "I've decided to leave the resurrection stone in the forest," and the portrait tells him that's the correct choice, and that I'm going to put the Elder Wand back where it was.
You know, David, I didn't think about that, but the idea that manifestation of Dumbledore at King's Cross is perhaps ghostly. That's not something that I've heard people really talk about as a way of thinking about him.
His hand is cured, and you know, the ghosts seem to look like they did when they died. So, but his hand is whole again. So that suggests to me that is not a ghost. That is a perfected body of some sort from the afterlife.
But spirit. In the Catholic sense that Emily was talking about. Mm-hmm.
It's a force ghost, clearly.
And there's that great line about Harry asks, "Is this really happening? It's all just in my head." And Dumbledore says, "Of course it's in your head, but why on earth should that mean it's not real?" Yeah. That is such a terrific and philosophically deep places I'm not going to touch. Why?
Yeah, right. And I mean, I think that's it, that hits so many things that she's saying here, right? That to really believe in the power of imagination and the power of what is happening internally in human beings. So as we're sort of thinking about the meaning of the ghosts, you know, they're very tied to Halloween
Oh,
and
yeah.
the holiday of Halloween. How do we understand? And Halloween, of course, is a big holiday at Hogwarts. You know, it's one of the big ones that's very celebrated, and you know, it's always associated with witches and so on. So, what do you think? And the ghosts, their relationship to Halloween, and how does this relate to the theme of what we're supposed to take away? And of course, All Hallows Eve is the origin of Halloween, and it is a kind of communion with the dead in a way that I think is intentionally being evoked here. So, what do you all
Right.
think of that connection between Halloween and the Hogwarts ghosts?
I will just add, and I don't think this is not typically common knowledge. I run into people all the time who are not aware of this, but Halloween is, as Katie said, All Hallows Eve. That's
Yeah.
where the name comes from. And it's the night before, the day before, the Feast of All Saints Day, which is a Catholic feast in which we celebrate all the holy men and women who have gone before us and their example, and we celebrate them. And then that is followed by All Souls Day, which is a day for celebrating everybody who has ever died, regardless of their holiness, you know, but we
Yeah.
hope that they are holy as well. We pray for their holiness and everything. So All Hallows Eve is this night. You know, that sort of there's this kind of cusp almost between living and dead, and Halloween kind of exists, and the traditions around Halloween have come up in as an expression of the that sort of liminal space between the living and the dead.
I've heard at least once that what happens is on All Saints' Day, the spirit of all the saints of all time is so strong that in preparation for that, everything which is wicked flees. And so on All Hallows' Eve, all the boogies, all the bad stuff has to run away. By the way, I've been wondering about a crack that's made. Halloween is also associated with skeletons, of course. How many cardboard skeletons that we see. And I remember at one point there's a rumor that going around that for Halloween, Dumbledore has booked a troop of dancing skeletons. Now that's never mentioned again, but I'm kind of wondering about that.
There's a lot to wonder about there.
I like this idea of Halloween as a kind of gateway. So that Halloween, and then of course the Feast of All Saints and All Souls Day, like that maybe there's a that the those three together might be considered to be a gateway between the living and the dead.
Oh,
And
good to
I
know.
think that is played out in a number of these realms that we've been talking about. Also, the Resurrection Stone is obviously doing that. And you know, I think that Priori Incantatum is a kind of interesting gateway. And then and the ghosts themselves represent some kind of gateway, although it's not completely open because the ghosts are not open to the world of the dead. But I was thinking about, you know, the veil, right? When you said, you know, you've got this the veil that maybe is thinner between them, or and but of course, that's not how the veil works in the Ministry of Magic either.
No.
So there is this irretrievable way that you can't actually go back and forth really, but there are these little tantalizing things that linger from the dead, that linger in the present world, that maybe give us some kind of access.
Well, and Dumbledore says that it's love that gives us that access, you know. So do you think that the dead that we have loved ever truly leave us? You know, and that is the way, that is the only way to, you know, legitimately and healthfully, you know, keep contact with that world of the dead. I mean, that's why Nick just turns Harry away. It's just like, no, don't go there. Don't go there. It's, you know, the implication is it's your love for this person that's going to keep him alive for you, not him becoming a ghost.
And you don't want your loved ones to be ghostly that way, and you also should not be aiming for that.
If you want access to, for a better word, I'll say physical, although spiritual, whatever, you know, like For instance, Harry wanted the company of his parents and Sirius and Lupin when he was walking to his death. You know, that was considered a noble use, an appropriate use of the stone, as opposed to the original brother who tried to bring a woman back from the dead for his own needs, even though that made her unhappy to be called back that way. I think that type of access to those who have gone on is pretty restricted at times. And you've got to want that, not for selfish reasons, but for very unselfish reasons. And I think that maybe that's part of what Nick was trying to say. It's like, no, you want Sirius back for yourself, and that's not going to happen. He would not do that. And you're not wanting what's best for him by wanting him back as a ghost.
Well, and it's also not good for his own grieving.
Yeah.
You know, and you can definitely see that in the future books. That, and I think the books are, I think, pretty clearly Rowling working through her own grief in some ways, but they are about things that are associated with grief and the processing of grief and doing it in ways that are healthy or not healthy, and you know what that tends to cause.
David, you mentioned a little sort of formula or equation that you have surrounding the significance of Halloween and Harry Potter. Tell us about that.
Oh, geez. Well, first of all, I shared this years ago with Connie Neal when she was doing a presentation on Halloween, and I came up after it's finished and I said, you missed one. She talked about the various Halloween celebrations. All right, it consists of two questions. One, what is Harry Potter's birthday? And any good Harry Potter fan will know the answer to that question. Two, what date is it exactly 9 months before Harry Potter's birthday? And if it's hard for you to go back nine, try going forward three. It does the same thing. And we'll leave it right there.
if I can add, I can't take credit for this one because I saw it in some sort of online meme. But to relate to that 9 month distance between Halloween and Harry's birthday, there's another, of course, the Potters died on Halloween. Mm-hmm. And Harry, at that time, Harry was taken to the Dursleys, where he stayed, not knowing about his heritage until his 11th birthday. That is exactly 9 3/4 years.
Oh my gosh.
That he was isolated between the time he started with the Dursleys until he learned he was a wizard. So is that connected to the platform? I don't know, but I saw that as a meme, and it's like, whoa, okay.
Fun, yeah, this with numbers.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
All right, listeners, don't say we never gave you anything. Those are some pretty nice little tidbits right there.
There's no extra charge for that information.
That's right.
Harry Potterversity.
That's right. Well, thank you so much, David and Louise, for being on the show today to talk all about ghosts.
Thank you. It's great fun as always. And I love being here and I love chatting with you, and especially seeing David again. I was very proud a few years ago to cheer him on from the studio audience at the Tournament of Houses. Even though I was there as a Ravenclaw, by the end, we were all rooting for the Hufflepuffs.
Well, thank you, Louise. And I apologize for not recognizing you sooner. My head was very full of other stuff at the moment.
Oh, gosh. So. Well, I yelled at David and got his attention from the audience in one of the breaks. And yes, well, there were lights. I was several feet above you. It was, anyway, I just wanted to let you know I was there rooting for you.
That's wonderful. Well, what a vibrant conversation we had about manifestations of the dead. and I really feel like I've learned a lot from this conversation. So I'm going to end the episode today with one of those quotes, one of those epigraphs from The Deathly Hallows. This is the one from William Penn, Fruits of Solitude, where he says, "Death is but crossing the world, as friends do the seas. They live in one another still, for they must needs be present, that love, and live in that which is omnipresent. In this divine glass, they see face to face, and their converse is free as well as pure. This is the comfort of friends, that though they may be said to die, yet their friendship and society are, in the best sense, ever present, because immortal.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.